The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect. Yes, this is the programme where you get the chance to talk about the stories and issues that matter to you right here on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Stephen Scott, I'm your host this week, and coming up, we'll hear about a school for the blind in Glasgow that recently closed its doors. We hear from former teachers and pupils of the school to find out about their thoughts on specialist education. Sheila Armstrong from Torch Trust drops in to tell us about the charity. That's our Society of the Week. We hear from a blind campaigner from RNIB. Frankie Rowan talks about how she got involved with the charity. An RNIB Connector talks to Sophie Fox about her recent experience setting up an event for visually impaired people in Bristol. And later we'll hear your guide dog stories as we once again pause for thought. But first, have you ever settled down to watch your favourite TV show on demand but found that the audio described version wasn't available? Well, this is more common than you might think, and thankfully RNIB are on the case. I sat down with Sonali Rai, whose job it is at RNIB, to talk to the broadcasters on our behalf. As Ofcom have launched a consultation on the amount of audio description on demand, as well as set-top accessibility, I thought it'd be a good time to chat with her to find out what's going on. So, let's talk about audio description, Sonali. It's a hot topic. Which it needs to be, and it's back in, certainly on your agenda. It's been on your agenda for a very long time. Tell us where we are in terms of video on demand services, because that's one area at the moment where we're not seeing much progress with audio description.
Sadly, I think that's true, Stephen. So audio description on video on demand services started with the BBC iPlayer launching description. I think this was back in 2009 or maybe have been 2010, but even then it's been about eight years, and the delivery is still very fragmented. It's still very patchy, so you might have description on certain channels, on certain platforms, certain devices, certain services, but there's no standardization, so you can't rely on a service. You can't absolutely know for sure when you switch from iOS to your web player whether it will support description or not, which programs will have description, which episodes will have description, when will it be available. There is no standardization, absolutely nothing at all.
And that's because at the moment there's nothing really in law, is there? I mean, talk us through the legislation at the moment in terms of the broadcasting side. For broadcasters, there are clear regulations in place. And in fact, in some cases, the broadcasters are exceeding those.
So legislation in broadcast, linear broadcast, was first introduced in 1996, which was the Broadcasting Act of 1996. It was subsequently updated in 2003, according to which all digital channels must deliver their content, 10% of their content, with audio description. Now, in reality, I think a lot of broadcasters are doing a lot more. In 2012, BBC, Channel 4, ITV and Sky voluntarily committed to doing 20%. Again, I would say all the channels are pretty much there. So if you look at the Ofcom Access Services report that they publish every 6 months, I think it's rare that you'll see any channel that's below 10%.
Which is incredible.
However, I think on video on demand, yes, there has been no legislation, but we would expect from our broadcasters, who have proven to be quite committed towards accessibility, making sure they have inclusive environments, to have done more to bridge this gap.
Yeah, because if they've got the content, they've spent the money and the time and made the effort to actually make the content and have it audio described. I mean, BBC, for example, would get EastEnders audio described, and you know, you'd want that to be available on demand. Now, that's a poor example, actually, because it is available on demand, but as you say, it's not consistent across devices. But let's take ITV, for example. Now, there are some programmes that are audio described. In fact, most programmes on ITV are audio described, but on demand, very few. And again, finding that content, from my understanding, if you've got an Android phone, you can get audio description.
That's correct.
But if you've got an iPhone, forget it. You're not getting it on demand.
Nothing on iOS, nothing on a web player. I think, again, Channel 4, really good in audio description, really good in accessibility when it comes to linear television. Mm-hmm. But if you look at on demand and catch-up television, so there's some programs are available on the web player for description, but if you switch to iOS or Android, there's clearly a gap.
So is legislation the answer? Is that, do you think that
what's happened with regulations regarding linear broadcasting coming into force for on-demand? Do you think that's it? Do you think that's what the broadcasters need, that push?
I think it'll certainly transform the landscape, yes. I sincerely think it is what's needed at the moment because, again, as I mentioned earlier, audio description was first launched on a catch-up platform in the UK in 2009. So it has been 9 years. However, we've not seen the sort of development we would have seen otherwise. I mean, innovation has been the cornerstone of the UK broadcasting industry. They're great at it. However, there is no focus on accessibility. And I think failure to allocate needed resources to make sure that accessibility becomes a part of the environment, part of your offering on demand.
Because you're not just talking about audio description here, you're talking about the set-top boxes as well. You know, if we talk about Sky or Virgin, UView to an extent, you know, these boxes are not inherently accessible to a blind person. You cannot use that box independently to find out what's on, what you've recorded. I mean, we saw, for example, Sky, who actually had a fairly accessible app which you could use to control Sky Plus. That was all effectively scrapped because they moved to the new Sky Q system. That system is not... It is accessible, the app is accessible, but it doesn't control the box because of the nature of what Sky Q does. So, you know, in a respect, they fix one problem and they create another. And accessibility just doesn't seem to be at the front of their minds.
Yes. Sadly, I think broadcasters or the wider industry is at the moment monetizing accessibility in a way. So
what do you mean by that?
So I think there needs to be a consistent focus on accessibility. Monetizing accessibility, by that I mean they are putting a cost on the development needed to deliver audio description on a catch-up or a video-on-demand platform.
So that's being used as a way of pushing back against what you would want, which we all would want. That is an accessible interface that allows us to not... I mean, it's two sides, really, isn't it? It's the accessible interface and the audio description. I think some of us would just settle for the audio description at the moment, but we don't want to settle. We want it to be accessible. I mean, look, we think about phones, we think about tablets, we think about computers. You walk into pretty much any high street department store that sells electricals, everything in that store is accessible. But when you go to the TV section, okay, some of the TVs are accessible in themselves, maybe the EPG is accessible, but you go and buy a Sky box or a Virgin box, which most people we might go out and buy, then you're not going to get accessibility built in.
So the roadmap for development or developing a platform has absolutely no focus, has no consideration for accessibility, for people who need talking menus or for audio description users, or even just making the player accessible, integrated with the voiceover, with TalkBack. I think there needs to be more focus here.
So there's a lot to do. I mean, you talk to the channels, you talk to the broadcasters, that's your part of your job. When you go to them, specifically around audio description, and you mentioned this, you obviously talk to them about it, what do they say? What's their reasoning? I mean, you've mentioned monetization. Is that the general answer you're getting now, which is it costs too much?
Sadly, not really, so not directly. Some of the broadcasters, yes, will say it's a commercial consideration at the moment and they've got other priorities. Other broadcasters will say they have been saying that it's on the roadmap and we will get to it once we've resolved the first few issues. But again, I'm going back to the length of time that's passed. So it's 9 years have passed. Not having done anything in the past 9 years, I think that shows lack of priority and lack of focus on accessibility and lack of interest, really.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about some of the other products out in the market at the moment regarding television? I mean, we're seeing a rise now in the number of smart boxes like Apple TV, which has been around for a long time, very accessible device. Amazon Fire Stick is another, and that recently has become a bit more accessible. But again, we have that problem, don't we, where some of it's accessible and some doors are locked, so we can get into some of the house. It's a bit like going to one of those museums, you know, where you go around an old house and they'll show you maybe two or three of the rooms and everything else is locked off. It's a bit like that with these devices, where you can get into some areas but not others. And I use the example in the Fire Stick of the apps themselves. So you can go to the BBC iPlayer, you can go into ITV Player, but that's as far as you can go. You can navigate yourself to these areas, but not into the apps and actually use the apps. So have you had any discussions with companies like Amazon, like Apple, around their accessibility?
So I think these need to be, so we have talked about these, because it's a BBC iPlayer or it's an ITV player or Channel 4's player, I think there needs to be collaboration around this. So if the app needs to be on a certain platform, the two need to collaborate on how to make it into a completely accessible experience. So for
the platform and the app have to combine, don't they?
Yeah. So the ITV Hub to be accessible on a Fire Stick, I think the two companies will have to talk to each other. And that's where I think the gaps are. I'm sure the two companies are talking to each other, but not about accessibility.
It's a long road. We've been on it a long way. It feels like we've been on this road for forever. But and you and I have been talking about this for I don't know how many years, probably nine, come to think of it. But I wish you all the best with it. I mean, you know, people obviously are very keen, you're very keen to get people involved in the campaign. And the good thing here, the good side of this discussion, especially around audio description, is that things are moving forward to some degree. It is through legislation. But people can still get involved, can't they?
Yes, it's an important milestone, and I would really urge people to get involved. So Ofcom are seeking responses from users of audio description or stakeholders of audio description to come forward and share their, not just their experience, but also comments on how description should be made available on these catch-up and video-on-demand services, how many programs should be available, what proportion, and should... Actually, they're not really consulting on the players, but it is something that we are looking at as well.
Okay. So what can people do, what should they do to get involved in that?
So the easiest thing would be to go to the Ofcom website and search for the video on demand consultation, or just search for it in Google, and that should have all the details.
Okay. And, you know, if people like me, who occasionally call you up and say, I'm not happy about this because... Can people still do that? Can we get in touch with you and tell your troubles regarding audio description, of course?
Always welcome, Stephen. Always welcome. So the easiest way to get in touch with me would be to write to the broadcasting mailbox, which is broadcasting@rnib.org.uk. And if you have specific suggestions around the consultation response, do get in touch, because that's something that we are working on at the moment.
Okay, brilliant. Sonali Rai, thank you as always.
Thank you very much.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Kelvin Primary School in Glasgow was one of the first of its kind to offer a mainstream education to its partially sighted pupils. The school has now closed, with pupils and staff heading to a new 21st century campus, as the old building was no longer fit for purpose. We're going to hear from some of the former pupils and staff now, looking back at their time in the iconic school, which was a former army barracks, and reminding us that sometimes those school days can be the best days of your life.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the day.
The children were so normal. I didn't know what to expect, but the children were like the children I had always taught. The school had about 60-odd children in. The bulk of them, I think there was a handful, were in what was called the special unit. The rest of the children were in five classes of about a dozen, and that carried on for many years. Meanwhile, the special unit was growing. We had some fantastic times. We had such fun. It was a nice place to be. It was pleasant to go to work in the morning. You just got so much from the children. In many years before, you had fought to teach. You didn't have to fight to teach in Kelvin. You felt as if you were being pulled along. Many times you were being pulled along by what the children wanted and what they needed, and you worked even harder to give them what they needed.
I had a sort of reputation, I suppose, as being the English, reasonable at language. So we always agreed that between us we made one good teacher. You got a reasonable standard of both language and maths if you passed through both out of hands. I think that was fair to say.
I could teach reading and I could teach spelling, but I didn't have the literary feel that you had.
I got the enjoyment from
that. You got that, yes.
The numbers to me were not boring, but you found them much more interesting.
Absolutely,
let's put it that
yes.
way. So you always were much more imaginative when it came to maths. But I used to do the stories after choir on a Friday.
So did I. I just didn't hand out the sweets.
Mean. Mind your salaries weren't good in those days, Tina. No, we had lovely afternoons at times. I retire so often that I think one time I handed back the gold earrings so that they could reward them back to me the next time I retired. So it was a wonderful school to be in. The staff were fantastic. I mean, they were all characters. They're all very, very individual people, tremendous personalities. There was a lot of fun and enjoyment attached to working in that school at that time. The pupils were, as I say, fantastic. They were very responsive. They all had a real thirst for knowledge. And we used to do wonderful Christmas concerts, summer concerts. It was just a wonderful school to work in. I can honestly say that when I was driving to work very often in the mornings, I felt happy that I was going to my work. And not many people can say that.
We had one particular friend and colleague who taught in the school, and she was so musical. She practically took over the music for the entire school. December every year was given over to the preparations for the Christmas concert, to which most of the area came. All the old people from St. Sixtus and from Kelvin Hall were specifically invited, but I think just everybody that heard it was on in such and such a date was there. We had standing room only. It was a brilliant concert. Year after year after year, we did some fantastic things.
And we used to try and write some original lines for the play, many of which had to be censored out because they didn't have double yellow lines in Roman times. And then there was a year we did one all in rhyme.
Yes.
We had some very inventive things.
That was Miss Rowan.
That's right.
Miss Rowan wrote them.
She wrote them.
She wrote many of them. Some came from child education, but the bulk of them came
from... No, we had some very original ones.
The bulk came.
The one about, you know, it's twins as he rushed out the stables, we had to censor that one out. The building itself, people used to think it was part of the barracks across the road because that's what it looked like. They always thought that the soldiers must sleep in there when they weren't working in the barracks. But that's exactly what it looked like. Rows of dormitories. Very, very inauspicious looking from the outside. But that, you know, belied the whole thing of what was happening in the interior of the school. The poignant part actually will be the garden as well, particularly the garden, I think, and the maze that we constructed in the playground, because there was so much effort from the children went into the production of that. So much involvement, so much cross-curricular activity. I mean, it just looked like a garden. But what the children didn't realise they were doing was they were actually doing maths, they were doing language, they were doing social skills, they were doing environmental skills. But it was so tied up in that project that that became a very meaningful part of the school for me in particular. So I'd be sorry to see that go. I'll miss walking down those long corridors, particularly in wet days when the buckets are out to catch the drips from the roof. I'll miss the extreme temperatures of the classrooms where in the winter they froze and in the summer they were biling hot. That's the sort of thing I'll probably miss the fun that we had. I don't think that atmosphere could too readily be recreated in many other places. It became part of the people who were there. The building was just so intricately interwoven with all of it. I'd like to sum up my career at Kelvin, particularly in the earlier years, as being by far and away the most enjoyable part of my entire teaching career. There is no doubt about that. I never felt I was teaching a class of children. I always felt I was teaching an extended family, really. I mean, one did form a very close association with the children. Even if they didn't want you to, you did. And the building itself, I don't want to be there when they knock it down because it's too full of memories for me. And I say, some not so happy, but the vast majority, very, very happy memories. So I'd rather not see what's happening to it until the new renovation or building or whatever is there. And I'll keep my own memories for my own mind and my own self.
I spent 25 years of my 37-year teaching career there. They were happy. That just sums it up. The building itself, my voice is beginning to crack already at the thought of it not being there. I really don't want to see. I can't even bring myself to go and say cheerio to them. But onward and upward. New Kelvin. New name, Hazelwood. All the best.
Some of the teachers from Glasgow's Kelvin Primary School there talking about their experiences of the specialist school. Later, we'll be hearing from some of the pupils. Time now on the Weekly Connect to talk about our Society of the Week. This time around, it's a society that focuses on disability and faith. It's called the Torch Trust. Sheila Armstrong, who works for the charity, in particular recording features for the popular Reflections radio programme, which airs here on RNIB Connect Radio every Sunday morning from 9am, has popped in to talk to me. Sheila, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I imagine many people will have heard at some point of the Torch Trust, which you've been involved in for a number of years. Is that fair to say?
More than I'd maybe like to admit on air.
It's been a while, and you've been there. Tell us, for those who don't know, though, what the Torch Trust is.
Well, the Torch Trust is an interdenominational organisation, so we're not attached to any church in particular, but the founders of Torch saw the need for blind people to get access to the kind of Christian literature that people might be using in churches and things like that, and also they recognise the need for friendship, and I suppose the old-fashioned word for it is fellowship, which is the word they used to use, but I think it's the same as friendship, really, of people to learn maybe more about their faith, to encourage each other. I mean, you know, we know that blindness can get you down in lots of ways, as can a lot of other things, but there is this need for friendship and reaching out, and especially for people who find themselves in the awful position of just starting to lose their sight. You know, they've maybe been driving or they've been doing things and suddenly it's all taken away from them. Like a lot of other organisations, we've recognised that that is a big need. So Torch is trying to address that need as well by trying to galvanise people in churches to reach out to people and be helpful to them in that way.
I know that one of the areas that you talk about a lot, and I, you know, being to your website, I listen to the programme Reflections, which is brilliant, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I guess I just want to sort of ask you a little bit about this subject of disability and faith. How does it link together?
Well, I suppose I thought about that while I was having lunch, actually, because I knew you were going to ask me this question. And I thought, in a way, it doesn't link easily together, because there are people, you know, within the church, and maybe people of other faiths can find this as well, but there are people within the church who read scriptures about the wonderful healing miracles of the Lord Jesus and various other scriptures that might suggest healing. And the big question is, what does healing mean? But there are some people who feel that, you know, there's maybe something wrong with you if you're not healed. So sometimes faith and disability, or blindness in particular, don't go that well together, because people have suggested to me, well, you know, if you had enough faith, your eyes would be okay by now, you know, and that's quite frankly quite an insult to me. So at Torch, you know, we recognise that people are whole people, and, you know, the fact that they're blind, well, I'm blind myself, but the fact that they're blind doesn't make them of less value, of less faith, of less ability to have faith than anyone else.
Because there are people who will say, you know, I thank God after they've lost their sight. And I've often wondered where people stand on that one. I mean, I'll be up front, I'm not a particularly religious person. So I'm always intrigued by this conversation. And I guess I'm a little bit more open to it than most, because I'm kind of on the fringes of it. But I just wonder, how does that work? How can you thank a God for losing your sight?
Well, I think we start from the place that we're in a very imperfect world. Whether you believe it was because Adam and Eve sinned against God or not, you can't really deny that we're in a very broken kind of world. And I mean, the news headlines show you that. So obviously, in this broken world, things are going to go wrong physically with people. All sorts of things can go wrong in the broken world. And if you have a faith and you believe that God gives free will, and, you know, that the problem is that something has gone wrong between us and our Creator, then you have to accept that things are going to happen. But I think in terms of thanking God, I think sometimes when people have lost their sight, there are some people who find that new opportunities have opened up to them in a way that they didn't have before. And even people without faith can find that as well, that they get into things that they'd never have thought of doing when they had all their sight.
But does having faith give you hope, more hope than perhaps you would if you didn't have faith, do you think?
Well, I think it does for me personally and for a lot of people that I know. Because I see this in terms of the world, you know, it is a broken place. But I believe that God is, you know, there is a future beyond what we are now. And it's not that I think, oh, well, it'll be okay soon. I live with my blindness. I do my best. You know, it is frustrating at times. I get annoyed with it. It's a blooming nuisance. I don't think it's a totally, you know, I wouldn't say, oh, well, I've had a gift from God, it's blindness. I mean, I know some people that say that. I don't really see it that way. I see that we're in a broken world and this is part of it. But I do believe that there is a God there who loves us and who has sent his son, the Lord Jesus, to bring people away from the margins into the fullness of society. And I believe that we are to work towards doing that.
And of course, there's nothing wrong with believing that if you believe that your sight loss is a gift from God, there's nothing wrong with believing that. You're entitled to your beliefs. And if you don't believe that, that's equally acceptable.
That's absolutely. I mean, I don't think I would go quite as far to say it's a gift from God, but what I do believe is that he's used it to advantage, to open up opportunities to me that I may not have had as a sighted person.
So while the programme Reflections is very much a Christian programme, it does speak to people of other faiths.
Well, we would love to feel it does, because we want to bring a message of hope and encouragement that, you know, blindness isn't the end of the line. And of course, a lot of other programmes and organisations are doing that as well. But the way that we do it is that we encourage people to focus on the fact that, you know, God is there and he loves us. And, you know, we want to bring good news about that, because it is good news in a broken world that, you know, God loves us. That is good news. And, you know, we want to bring that to people, whether they would say that they're a Christian or not a Christian. And, you know, just to find the value in people, which, you know, a lot of people are doing. I'm not saying that only Christians can do that, but we, you know, we do look for the value in people. And we have people on the programme that are not necessarily Christians, but they're doing something really interesting, or maybe something sort of outstanding as a blind person or as a disabled person. And, you know, we don't hide the fact that it's a Christian programme, so we're very upfront before we interview anyone what kind of programme it is. And we still find that people want to come on, so that's just great.
Because there's not many people, let's be frank about it, not many discussing that link between disability and faith that Torch Trust talks about.
No, I think not. And, you know, sometimes we've come across people of other faiths who might feel it quite a difficult to make that link between their faith and being blind or being disabled in some way or other. And, you know, I think it's something that does need talking about and does need exploring and investigating, because, you know, if we do believe in God, we've got to believe that he values everyone equally. And also, if we're in a broken world, that he's aware that some people's eyes are not working.
Mm. You talk about broken world, fractured society, however you want to put it. Mm. Do you think that, because we do live in a very secular society now, less people go to church, less people are of faith, it seems. Whether that's entirely true or not, we don't really know the full picture, but we certainly know that society is moving towards a more secular view. Does that make what you do a bit more contentious as an issue every week? Are you finding that? Or?
Well, it could do. Actually, the other radio station that we run on, Premier Christian Radio, has quite a lot of strict rules that we can't get into any political issues, or, you know, there are things that we have to be very careful not to do as far as they're concerned. So that does clip my wings somewhat, because I'd love to get into more contentious discussions with disabled people about things.
Yeah.
But, you know, having said that, I'm not wanting to do programmes that's going to discourage people. I mean, I don't know about you, Steve, but I get fed up with reading in, say, Braille magazines, or if in your case it maybe be audio ones, about all the stuff that's not working technically for blind people, because I know it's not working and I don't need to hear it again. And I don't think that people, you know, need to hear that, you know, it's difficult to be a blind person with my faith and all that kind of thing. And I don't believe it is for Christians, or it shouldn't be. And I think part of our thing is to encourage people who have blindness or disability. But a very important part is to make people who don't feel that they've got a disability aware of maybe some wrong attitudes that they have towards disabled people. And I do feel that's part of our remit as well.
You've been, as I mentioned at the beginning, you've been part of Torch Trust for a while. You do interviews, you do recordings for the Torch Trust programme. Is there more you do with the organisation?
Well,
is that enough?
It is. But I did run the Braille computer transcription for a while, and it is a bit more automated now than it was when we were doing
it,
because of advances in Braille translation software. But there are times when I can give a bit of help on the Braille front of things. I mean, we do still get actual Braille paper Braille letters into Torch sometimes, and there's only one or two of us that can read them now. So
it's quite sad, isn't it? It's quite sad in a way that Braille's got to that level.
Well, it is, but I mean, I must admit, I don't write many paper Braille letters myself, so why should anyone else?
That's one way to look at it. Yeah. But you have an interest in technology. You certainly have an interest in you know, the advances in technology, which is important. Growing up, I mean, technology has changed a lot. I mean, even in the last 5 years, I mean, you could even argue in the last year, technology changes so quickly these days. What's been the sort of biggest change for you?
Well, I think one of the major changes for me was when the Kindle app went live on phones, because suddenly you could get access to loads and loads of books that weren't available because they haven't been transcribed. And it didn't matter whether an author decided it should be speech enabled or not, because the phone would read it anyway. So that was really good, that to me, because I'd accidentally bought a few books that weren't speech enabled on Amazon. And I was really annoyed because I paid good money for them and I couldn't read them because they weren't speech enabled. But as soon as it went live on the phone, I was able to read those very books. So that was a big change. And I think some of these image recognition softwares, such as the AI one, what's it called? Windows AI.
Seeing AI.
My mind went blank, sorry. Seeing AI and Apoly Vision and some of these other ones are very important, because whilst they might not be totally accurate, if you're totally blind as I am, I can just see light and dark. You might want to try and identify something. You might not need to know everything about it, but it's just, what is it? What's this bit of paper? What was it? Is it an important letter? Can I chuck it away? And it will read enough for you to at least determine that much. So that's a great help to me as a blind person.
But of course, the ultimate book, I guess, for you as a Christian is the Bible itself.
Yeah,
and
that's
being
correct.
Able to access that has, I guess, with technology, been made easier.
Yes, I do have a Braille Bible, but it takes towards 5 feet of shelving, which, is quite a lot.
I wouldn't like to have been the delivery man who dropped
well,
that off.
Well, it came in dribs and drabs. It didn't come in a one or so.
That's good news.
Yeah, it was good news for the delivery man, I think. Yeah, but now I've got a note taker that has 5 different translations, because, of course, different people, different groups of scholars have translated the Bible from the original Greek and Hebrew at different times. And it can help you. Obviously, you know, I did Latin at university. It was I wasn't very good at it, but I could see straight away the difficulty of getting the tone of a thing when you're trying to translate it. So it's really a great thing to be able to read different translations that different scholars have set their minds to. How can I get the tone of this thing over? And I think it's very important to have different translations, but they weren't available to us until relatively recently. I can get it on the phone. I can get it on my Braille note taker. And we've got Daisy versions now of 2 or 3 different Bible versions.
So it really has changed the way you can access. I mean,
it has.
It's not just one book you have option. You have the book.
Yeah.
But you have variants, versions.
But I mean, the Bible is like a library. I mean, Biblia means library, of a collection of 66 different books. So,
yes,
you know.
That's right. Yeah. Which, funnily enough, I only learned that very recently, what the word Bible actually meant.
All right.
I didn't know that. That was very interesting,
yeah,
actually. It makes sense.
People use it in a bit of a loose way now, don't they?
Yeah, they
like
do.
The Gardener's Bible. There's somebody else's Bible.
So Torch Trust is ongoing, and is it thriving? Is it going from strength to strength?
Yeah, I think so. We're putting more effort now into trying to get close to people where they are, rather like R&IB Connect is doing. But we want to we realised that although there are a lot of churches closing, what you say is true. The fact is there are still churches in nearly every area of the country, if not every area. So there's a great potential there if people are willing to help visually impaired people. So we're having a thing called the Sight Loss Friendly Church, and we're trying to help churches to understand that, you know, it's not another box to tick. It's quite easy, and we just want to give them materials and resources to help. So one thing we have is a thing called Transcription Transforms, and churches can register for that, and that allows you to easily get large print in different point sizes without having to create different files to do it. You can do it from the one file, provided it's styled up in the editor, or even Braille if the church has got an embosser, or if somebody can use a Braille file into a note taker if they've got that kind of thing. And we have also heard of some churches that are streaming Wi-Fi from the... Because the big problem now in churches is the projector screen. Everything goes up on the screen and people can't access it if they're not able to see. And it's even a problem for people in wheelchairs, because if everyone's standing up in front of them, it blocks their view.
Yeah.
So it's not just a problem for blind people. And we do find that some wheelchair users have taken our large print from the Worship for All Transcription Transforms programme. Not because they needed the large print, but because they would get blocked from seeing what's on the screen.
Mm.
So that can be a help. And then, of course, the face-to-face, if we could just get people in churches to have training, because, you know, with the best will in the world, you might just breeze up to a blind person and start pulling them along or doing something that's not very appropriate. So we realise that we've got the ability to train people of the best way to approach people, safe guiding, you know, practical things like that. And also the big thing, the fact that the blind person, if they're really blind, can't make eye contact. So in a way, the onus is on the person who can see the blind person to start up the conversation, especially a lot of churches have a bit of a coffee and tea after church. And that can be a nightmare because people can be left sitting on their own or, you know, because they can't really get into the conversation. So it's just educating people really and really showing that it's actually very easy to make that kind of contact.
It sounds like great work you're doing at the organisation, and I wish you all the best.
Thank
Sheila.
You.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's time to meet another RNIB connector who is doing their bit in the local community to bring together blind and partially sighted people. Laura Brennan is a lead Community Connect volunteer in Newton Abbott and hosted her first Connect get-together recently. Laura also spoke to Sophie Fox about the Connect Southwest Facebook group and how it has impacted her life in a very positive way.
I set up a group with the help of Sophie to try and get people to meet up once a month, just for coffee and a chat, just to get them out of their houses and to meet some new people with the same sight problems as us. So it seemed to go really, really well. We had quite a good take-up, didn't we?
So, yeah, it's a good amount of people there.
Yeah,
taking over the whole coffee shop that we're in the library.
Yeah, and then we're hopefully, sort of once we all get to know each other a little bit more, we can start to decide if we want to sort of do other things, maybe go out for a day or go out for lunch. So it's just sort of feely-feely at the moment,
that
really, isn't
really,
it?
That does sound rather nice, going out for lunch.
That sounds very good.
Yeah. You were even talking about maybe going to a festival or something like that the other day.
Yeah, we were talking about getting something set up for the summer where we can either go down on the beach for a barbecue.
Oh, yeah.
Or meet up at one of the beer festivals, which I think sounds a very good idea.
That sounds excellent,
yes.
I think.
Yeah, because I tried sorting out doing some sort of festival, but there were so many rules and regulations and costs involved that it would have just got too complicated.
Yeah.
So, just get together. And there doesn't seem to be anything in Newton Abbott, really. It's a bit of a black hole for social life, really. So we'll get things sorted.
So we met a few new people today, a few new faces.
Yeah, and I think it was just nice for people that maybe don't always get the opportunity to come out, to come and, as I say, talk to other people, because you do feel sometimes you're the only person that has got your problems, or
yeah,
like that lady we was talking to, you sort of give her some information as to where she can get some help or just have a chat with. I enjoyed it. It was really nice.
Very lovely. Morning, I was about to say afternoon then. It's been the morning.
It's been a long day.
And you're also a very big fan of Facebook and our Facebook groups.
Oh, yes, it's wonderful. Yeah, the RNIB. Oh, I said it right. it's wonderful. Yeah, I've sort of got to meet some really nice people on it. And again, it's nice just offloading. And we don't talk all about our site all the time and how sad everything is and we can't see and... It's nice. It's really good fun. We all get on really, really well. I love it. It's given me a lot of my confidence back. I'd be quite lost without it now. If I'm bored, I'll just go on and have a nose and see who's on and have a chat. And
there's a really lovely sense of like camaraderie on it, I think.
There really is.
Everyone's on there to kind of help each other out, give each other advice.
And we all sort of get involved in each other's posts. Someone will just be talking to someone else and then we'll all stick our beaks in and sort of give our 10 penneth and... God, I sound like old, don't I, 10 penneth? I don't even know what a 10 penneth is. No, it's a really, really nice site. I think we definitely all need to get together and do something exciting.
So if anyone's wondering what this Facebook group is, there's a different Facebook group for all of the different regions across the UK. So we're part of the South West Connect group. So if you go on the RNIB page on Facebook and go to groups, you will be able to find it there. So it's Facebook... .com/groups/RNIB Connect Southwest.
Oh, such a mouthful. I just get so confused.
So easily done, isn't it? If you want to find out more about RNIB Connect Facebook groups in your area, all you've got to do is search for RNIB Connect on Facebook. Now, time to catch up with the RNIB campaigns team, but this time we flip things around a little bit. Instead of hearing about an ongoing campaign, we thought it might be interesting to let you meet one of the local campaigners who's blind herself. Jessica Hall takes up the story.
Our campaigning at RNIB just wouldn't be possible without blind and partially sighted people all over the country willing to take action and call for a more equal and accessible society. And this month we caught up with Frankie Rowan, who's a new volunteer campaign coordinator from Durham in the northeast of England.
I lost my sight a couple of years ago off the back of a stroke. So I currently have no sight in my right eye at all and no central vision in my left. I've got diabetic retinopathy and glaucoma in the left eye as well. But with regards to my sight loss, it is actually a recent thing. I had 20/20 vision up until a couple of years ago till I actually had the stroke. So a bit of a big change for me.
Frankie explains how she first came across RNIB and first heard about campaigning with us.
I attended an event at St James's Park Football Stadium in Newcastle where there were various different sight services and groups and sort of businesses to do with sight loss. So there was a lot of technology groups there. There was obviously charities there and things. And that's where I first met Mike Hall and Francesca Di Giorgio from the RNIB. And they sort of had a chat with me and explained all about sort of RNIB Connect and campaigning and what their sort of main aims and goals were. And it just sounded really interesting. I had a lot of kind of ideas. And also I was ready to sort of hear other people's ideas and things as to what the charity and things were all about. Again, with it being a relatively new thing for me, I wasn't really aware of any of the work that the RNIB did or anything like that.
Campaigning is a great way to use skills that people have picked up throughout their lives and careers. Frankie told us about her job and how it's helping her to develop her campaigning skills.
My previous job, I worked as a prison officer, which obviously made me come into contact with various different people from various different backgrounds, a lot of quite challenging situations at some time. But also I think the main skill you need to do that kind of job is to be a good communicator. So I consider myself as a good listener. I can adapt to what people are saying, and I'm quite good at taking things on board and also giving my opinion as to how things can maybe improve or how people can look at things in maybe a different way. So I think my experience as a prison officer definitely helps with regards to connecting campaigning, because obviously you get people who've been campaigning things for years who might not have seen things from a, quote, younger perspective, or they might have sort of been doing the same sort of thing and have the same sort of goals for a long time. So I think it helps being a campaigner and being able to listen and communicate and also get your opinions and points across in a relatively simple manner, really.
Great to hear from Frankie and her encouragement for younger people like herself to get involved and get out there in making change happen. If you felt inspired by what Frankie had to say, then there are lots of ways to take part. You can sign up to our monthly campaign e-news to hear about opportunities for taking action. Simply visit our website www.rnib.org.uk/campaigns or call our campaigns hotline on 020 739 91 2123.
The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, earlier we heard from some of the teachers of Glasgow's Kelvin Primary School, a specialist school for blind children which closed its doors recently. Let's now meet some of the pupils. Did they think their school days were the best days of their lives? Let's find out.
Thank you for the day.
I think for me there were so many good memories of Kelvin School. I mean, everything from primary 1 right up to primary 7 when we left the school. Certainly primary 2 brings back, or class 2 it was called, there was a wee story corner. And it was really nice to kind of go there. I can't remember what afternoon, but we used to go there with Miss Rowan. We all used to huddle round together and we'd get a story or we'd be able to choose a book. That was a kind of really nice memory. Other kind of good memories are things like the milk corner of each classroom, which was an opportunity for the class to gather and have their gossip morning. Everything from the music room, that's where I learned to play the recorder with Mrs. Thompson, which was fantastic. And again, I've kind of gone on, not to take it up, but I can still whistle a wee tune.
A fond memory I have of being at Kelvin is when we were older, we were allowed to go to the swimming, which was outside the school, which was like an adventure, getting out for a couple of hours in the afternoon, coming back to the school. Then it was home time, and you just went home, you had nothing else to do in the afternoon, you felt as if you had a whole day to yourself. It's great.
One thing that was really horrid about school, obviously, was the school dinners, especially the custard with the skin in it. Oh, couldn't think of anything more disgusting.
There weren't many things I didn't like about Kelvin School, but certainly two spring to mind. One, because it was a school specially for visually impaired children, you were almost put in a protective environment. You can imagine being in class all morning and looking forward to being out in the playground and running some of that energy off. But in Kelvin, there were many rules, and one of them was no running. And they're probably for very practical reasons, as you probably don't want sort of 40 or 50 visually impaired kids running around. And one morning I decided not to listen to the rules and was running about the playground and therefore implanted my two front teeth into poor Yvonne's head, and she was whisked off to York Hill Hospital and I was whisked off for an emergency dental appointment.
I think Kelvin gave you a good standard of education, because if you couldn't do something, the teacher would sit with you until you learned how to do it, especially the times tables. There was numerous occasions I had to repeat the times tables and I still don't know them. But I thought it was a really good education, because your reading skills, your writing skills, whatever, were basically, I think they were higher than they were at the normal primary schools.
One of my favourite memories of being at the school was an annual trip to the circus at the Kelvin Hall. For one, I mean, it was like just like a family outing. I mean, Kelvin School was an extension of your family. Everybody in it, the teachers, the pupils, because it was such small class sizes. And I think it was enlightened even more having a visual impairment, because you had all the smells of being at the circus. So you just didn't appreciate the show itself, but you appreciated all the smells and the sounds that were going on round about you as well.
The school trip that mainly sticks in my mind is probably the same as everyone, is Ayr. Every year we went to Ayr. I got up in the morning all excited. We went to school, we on the bus down to Ayr. We went to the beach, we went to the amusements. It was great, basically. We could just hang about with our friends. The teachers and stuff were there, but we could just hang about with our friends, felt as if we had freedom. And I feel as if that was quite good for a school for visually impaired people, to let them actually do that themselves.
My memories of the building were very strange. It wasn't a conventional primary school as you would imagine, as in a stone or a brick building. It was wooden army barracks, I believe. They were in the shape of a square, with the perimeter of the square being the building, and inside that square was the playground. It was a very kind of weird shape, but a comfortable and intimate school.
The building was different, unique even. If you remember it getting painted one year a kind of pinky colour, and then obviously that paint peeling off, and then it getting painted another colour. The playground, that was great. Having it all lined off so that the boys could all play football, and I can remember some of the boys running round as well, playing at cars, pretending they were cars. And I also remember going out and playing, and we were playing at British Bulldogs, despite the fact we were told numerous occasions not to. Mrs. Fallow or Mrs. Hughes watching, you couldn't do anything out of order when they were about. You had to kind of, if you were going to be misbehaving, there was a wee corner, they couldn't see you, so, or at least we thought they couldn't see you.
What I remember about the building was you weren't allowed, obviously, to stay in at playtime. If it was raining, you were allowed to walk right round the whole building to the dinner hall, which I thought was truly amazing, because you couldn't go outside, you just to walk round the big square, and I just thought it was amazing. I loved the gym hall as well. And one particular memory I have about the gym hall is Mrs. Deary going up on the climbing bars. And it was just so funny, I just can remember it to this day.
I'd sum up my time at Kelvin as being very educational and making loads of friends as well, who I still keep in touch with. The building, in one word, was ramshackled, but it was a nice building.
I will be sorry to see Kelvin actually being pulled down. It was a great school. There was loads and loads of great people went to it, for years and below, obviously. And it's just had such a great atmosphere, so many pupils done so well out of it. And I will be sorry to see it going. I mean, the school will live on in the new school, and obviously the pupils that have been there beforehand and ourselves. Bye-bye, Kelvin, I will be sorry to see you go.
Well, Kelvin, just like to say goodbye. There'll never be another school like you. You were unique, brilliant, and you'll be missed, I'm sure.
Kelvin School, 69 Nairn Street. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. You listened to me, you taught me, you educated me, and for that I thank you very dearly. You will be gone, but certainly not forgotten.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the day.
Former pupils of Kelvin Primary School in Glasgow talking there about their experiences of the school after it closed its doors recently. Many thanks to Alan Russell for producing that for us. Finally on the Weekly Connect this week, a story about a guide dog that took its owner into a pet shop every day went viral online recently. You might have heard about it. Well, we thought we'd ask guide dog owners out there about their thoughts on this story and also their own funny stories about their furry friends.
It surprises me, like the owner with the dog who was going into the pet store and having treats. Like, how do you not know that? Like, come on. You must know, you know, have a bit of common sense just to kind of think, you know, put yourself in the right context and wonder where you are and what you might be doing and stuff. And I'd kind of be questioning if my dog sort of took me into somewhere. I'd be like, where are we going, you know? Like, quite often he'll indicate at a door, you know, we've been here before, and he'll sort of stop and pause, like, are we going in here? Surely it's on the owner a bit to sort of control the dog, and, you know, the dog shouldn't be sort of just taking you random places.
These all could be urban legend stories I'm going to tell you. However, I do have one that I can identify as being true. The first one is the story of a guy who was a smoker who every day on his way to work would travel with his dog guide independently, and he would always stop at the same store to buy his cigarettes. Well, one day he decided that he needed to go on a health improvement kick and decided that he was going to stop smoking. Well, he didn't tell his dog, because for weeks he had to go into the store that he bought his cigarettes from because the dog would go to the door of the store and not want to work anymore until he was able to get the dog to move by going into the store. And so he would go in and buy a pack of gum, which actually helped him to stop smoking.
My guide dog always tends to find me cafes and coffee shops. I think he's just quite good at sort of knowing, you know, what I might like, or, you know, he sort of preempts what he thinks I might like, which is quite generous. When they like, when our team trained with them, when he was doing his advanced training, he spent a lot of time in cafes because the trainers liked cafes, and he's just sort of taken that with him, really. He likes the vets for some reason. You hear about, like, owners and their dogs, and they won't, you know, the dog won't take them into the vets because they don't want to go. My dog always tries to go in the vets when we walk past it. It's like, oh, yay, for some reason.
Now, the story that is true that has happened to me is my first dog guide, whose name was Strider, and I was in college at the time, and there was this little mom-and-pop restaurant that every day for lunch I would go and stop at. It was called Mary's Diner, of all places. And Mary's Diner had food, you know, good food. It was decent, I guess you would say, and inexpensive, and for a college student, that's perfect. Well, this dog learned how to get to that place very quickly. Strider did. And I could not figure out why until one day I found out. The cook was making him sausages in the back, and every time he would come in, the cook would bring him 3 or 4 sausages. And I wondered why he was getting fat, and I finally found out.
Such great stories, and thank you to all of you for sharing. If you want to share your story, then we would love to hear your thoughts on that particular story, or indeed any of the stories we've covered here on the Weekly Connect this week or on previous weeks. Remember, you can check out our podcast, check out RNIB Connect on iTunes or Audioboom, and keep up to date with the programme. Keep in touch as well. The email address is theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. You can also get in touch on Twitter @RNIB Radio. That's it from me, Stephen Scott. Thank you so much for being here. Remember, when it's Mondays at 1 o'clock, say it with me, it's The Weekly Connect. Goodbye.